This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Front Row on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Sharmila Ganesan. The Tempest is often considered to be one of William Shakespeare's best plays, combining tragedy, comedy, and romance by using themes like magic and art. And the play is being reimagined for an upcoming staging in Kuala Lumpur by David Glass, who is, of course, renowned to be one of the founders of the physical, devised, and applied theatre movements. The show is on at the Kuala Lumpur Performing Arts Centre from the 28th to the 31st of March. And David is here with me today to tell us more. How are you doing, David?
Very good. Yeah, very good. Enjoying being here in Kuala Lumpur. I always have very warm welcome by all my Malaysian art friends.
I think in these couple of weeks, it's literally been very warm.
I think that's right, both physically and metaphorically warm.
So I'm very curious. I suppose within the context of the work, this makes sense. But you're calling the show a reimagining of The Tempest.
Yes, I think if anybody comes along, they'll have a sense of The Tempest, Shakespeare said, but we're not doing his play. Mm. I would say that right up front, honestly. It's a reimagining. I think, to be honest, the one weakness of The Tempest is full of, as you say, wonderful themes, wonderful moments, great language and great poetry, but it actually lacks a story. Caliban wandered around looking for wood for about half of it. And so we have a much tighter story. And in fact, without giving too much away, it reflects two films that were very much influenced by The Tempest. One is Blade Runner and the other one is Alien, believe it or not. Both of them were influenced.
Yes.
And so I've sort of created a backwards futuristic story of this. But The Tempest has been used many times in the past to be reimagined because of its weakness as a plot, but great stimulation for other artists.
Obviously, the kind of work that you do does lend itself very well to taking these themes and then sort of creating something new around them. How big a deal is it when you work with something like Shakespeare?
Well, obviously coming from England, being a so-called English artist, Shakespeare is both a great inspiration, but also a terrible sort of albatross around your neck, like any great writer. I wouldn't say I am an interpreter of Shakespeare. I have done as workshops, but I have never really done Shakespeare in a conventional sense, if there is such a thing, you know. But my background in studying in Lecoq and Grotowski, both of them, we had to do Shakespeare as part of that. And I spent some time in Peter Brook's company in Paris, where he did The Tempest while I was there, in fact. He was exploring it.
Maybe if we take a little bit of a step back, you are usually described as a pioneer in the field of physical and visual, devised and applied theatre movements. You must get asked this all the time. Mm-hmm. But if you would indulge us a little bit, for those of us who may not know, what does that actually mean? What does devised theatre, applied theatre mean?
I think devised theatre is really, all theatre in a way is devised by a writer. They make it up. But devised theatre basically starts with the company of performers who might be performing it. And we research and develop a project together in the rehearsal room. And so the visual, physical language of it is just as important as the text that is spoken. Whereas comparing it to conventional theatre, which is basically a writer, a script, a producer and director, and then interpreted by actors. Very good model, not one which I'm really myself do a lot of. Whereas for me, we explored playing with plastic bags, for instance, in the play. We explored music. It's really a more, I'd say, laboratory approach, which then produces very, very polished work. And if you've seen any work of Théâtre de Complicité, Pina Bausch, any of these, I suppose Robin Lepage, Cirque du Soleil, these are all devised companies. Stomp, a great devising company.
So when it comes to the way in which you work with your actors, your crew, and so on, how does the process work?
Well, it's collaborative. And for me, the first thing you have to do is create relationships. In fact, we don't want to be creative, any of us, when we get up in the morning. We want to have relationships with each other, the world around us, and ourselves. Focus on the relationship and the process and the outcomes, if there are such things, really, will follow naturally. But if you endlessly try to fit it into some sort of box and say it'll be like this, great creativity doesn't work like that. You know, Shakespeare, actually, he would have probably been collaborative. He would have listened to his wife and she would have said, no, not to be or live. It was to be or not to be. You know what I mean? Everything's a collaboration. We're not artists alone. So collaboration and relationship, I think, sits at the center of this.
How do you think the practice of device theatre has evolved over the years from the time when you first started working in it?
Well, I think, again, my roots were at Le Coq School of Paris, and there we had the Haute Cour, which grew out of the 68 sort of uprising, which where basically the students took over the school. And Le Coq said, no, carry on, just make your work. And it was about empowering the artist, the actor as artist first, rather than just purely be interpretive. It's changed a lot. It's grown. It has grown, spread. These movements have grown in the time when I started in my 20s. So now I'm 61, all over the world, you know. And you'll see this Lee Ching, who's a director at KLPAC. She uses device theatre. So each one makes their own. And I always say to all my students, I say, I give you the tools, break the tools and make your own.
Obviously, you're the artistic director of the David Gloss Ensemble, but you also work with different companies around the world. You do training.
Yeah.
I suppose the question is, with so many different people interpreting device theatre for their own works, how do you continue sort of engaging and learning and evolving?
I think listening is the first thing. Listening and watching. I try to say to my students, you know, when the first year you spend at drama school or art school is look at the world. Look at things. Don't have opinions. Just look, see. And so I still do that. You know, I spend a lot of time walking around. When I rehearsal's intense sometimes, but I love to spend that, even whether it's in the shopping mall, on the street here in KL, I see people. And that influences my work. But then I also use things like Facebook as my artist studio. If anybody knows me on Facebook, then I'm a provocative, slightly irritating idiot who, but I steal from all kinds of places and I mash it up and I create new creations all the time. So as a personal art form, I am very impure. I will take, borrow, twist, transform really all the time.
And I think that's actually quite reflected in the process that you, when you work with your actors, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. I think the important thing really for me is that you have to find out what the seed of the idea of the story is, and then what the story is, and then how do you tell it? Not the other way around. You don't say, I want to tell it in a Marvel style, film style. You say, what is the seed? So for instance, The Three Sisters is expressed perfectly in the way Chekhov's written it. It works in a kind of a naturalistic, realistic world. But every story has its way of being told. There is no reality. It's all made up, basically, play on stage. And play is a very important part of my process. I let the actors play. I don't let them be too serious or too earnest. I think that's often damaging for theatre.
So when it comes to The Tempest,
yeah,
what do you think is the seed of the story?
I think it's at the heart of the story is an older man who has a daughter who wants all the things that a teenage daughter wants, which is love and life and adventure, who is holed up basically on a not very good resort island and nothing much is happening. And he has made some very bad choices and made choices that have been mad for him. That's the seed of it, his relationship between a father and a daughter, regret. We've taken that to be a much bigger metaphor. I won't give too much away, but very much about the future. It's a post-human world we're exploring here. And so I think that the relationship between fathers and daughters are at the heart of this in a way.
You know, the thing is, as many people who study literature would say, Shakespeare is quite a structured sort of a play. How does that work when you apply it to something that, to me, seems quite fluid when it comes to your approach?
Well, all theatre should be structured in the end. It's an architecture. Storytelling is an architecture. You have a beginning, middle, and end. The beginning is people, place, and then a problem. Follow the problem through. The problem is to one person wanting to get off the island and fall in love. The other person is trying to revenge himself on his brother.
Yeah.
Follow those two stories through, and you'll go down the rabbit hole eventually. You know what I mean? You follow the money. But I think Shakespeare is and isn't structured. You know, I think there's a lot of what can I say without being rude in any way to anybody? But I think we don't really know. We you know, there's a lot of research, there's lots of academia around it. But in a way, he was also a showman. He wrote plays. Yeah. Some of them were good. Some of them were not so good. Some of them, I'm sure people said, I don't know what that was about. Mm-hmm. Other ones were farcical. And he was like any good writer. He wanted to entertain.
And he wrote them for a very broad audience.
Exactly so. You know, I mean, no one ever talks about this, but, you know, like, you know, 20% of his language is rude swearing. We just don't get it anymore sometimes. Yeah. You know what I mean?
So you did say that you've reimagined it in ways where, you know, you're not necessarily telling the story of the Tempest as Shakespeare wrote it.
No, not at all.
Is there a story at all?
Oh, yes. No, we have a bloody good story. We've got a really good plot. I was saying to them the other day, well, this would make a great film. I hope people coming out, it'd be interesting what they say. But the story is very important in this. I don't want to give anything away, but I think it's a very central part of the entertainment is the plot.
So what are the commonalities in terms of what will people recognize?
I think they'll recognize the magical quality of the world, Ariel's enslavement. They'll recognize the difficulty of the relationship between Prospero and his daughter, Miranda, aching as she is for love. I think they'll see a lot of the themes in it, which are basically greed, death, and love, the three big themes. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the overall atmosphere of anything possible might happen, and an isolation on an island as well. Beyond that, I think they'll also see it's very different. So in a way, a bit of what you expect, and also hopefully lots of what you don't expect.
We do need to take a break, but when we come back, we will speak more to David Glass about bringing the Tempest to life in KL in some very unexpected ways, I think. I'm speaking to David Glass, who is the artistic director of the David Glass Ensemble. He is directing an upcoming staging of Shakespeare's The Tempest at the Kuala Lumpur Performing Arts Centre. We'll be back after a short break. You're listening to Front Row on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Front Row on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Sharmila Ganesan. I'm speaking to David Glass, Artistic Director of the David Glass Ensemble and one of the pioneers of the physical devised and applied theatre movements. David is here directing a reimagining of Shakespeare's The Tempest at the Kuala Lumpur Performing Arts Centre from the 28th to the 31st of March. So David, the show is being described as a co-production between David Glass Ensemble, between the KL Shakespeare Players, as well as the actor studio, Sunny Theatre Rakyat. What does that actually mean?
Co-productions, I suppose, are ways of people sharing potentials of projects. Mm-hmm. I think that's the thing. The creativity, but also the structuring, the organisation of it. And in this case, I tend to work within a framework where we partner with local companies and artists, and in the hope that we can then exploit, is the word sometimes is used, not a good word, I don't think, but exploit it to take it beyond. So, for instance, I have partnerships in 7 cities in China. Mm-hmm. This would be a very good tour in China. It'd be great to bring either the whole company or part company, part Chinese company to join it. Similarly, also in Europe, I have a lot of theatres I work with there. So it's really a way of growing projects. Also, I never feel pieces are finished. There are shows I directed 20 years ago that I'm still working on. It's just they're just one stage long. So I imagine we do the first iteration, we'll basically open here and it'll tour in a lot of schools. That'll be influenced the way we tell it. And then eventually I'll probably come back and do a second version of it, which might be a little bit more spectacular, might use a bit more, just have a bit more money and resource in it. you know, but all of it is really about just re-engaging, getting audience, especially young people, into the theatres, and not feeling that theatre's boring, but it's an exciting as a rock concert. That's my idea. You know, we mustn't bore people. We must excite them.
And you're working with an entirely local, entirely Malaysian cast. Yeah. Who are some of the people that we'll be seeing?
Well, Kian Lee, who runs KL Shakespeare Players, and Sun Heng, both of them have been running it for I think 9 years now. They are very much much key players in it. Nikki, who's in fact a broadcaster herself, works on the news, and she's a wonderful actress.
This is Nikki Basharuddin.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, absolutely. She's wonderful. Sorry, I'm used to using all their first names. also, Sui, who's a wonderful Bhutto dancer himself.
Lee
Sui-kyung. Yeah, Sui, yeah. Very well known here. Sorry, I'm using all their sort of...
No, that's fine. That's what I'm here for.
Okay. And then a very young actor called Jun, I can't remember his last name now. He's basically, he's just... graduated from LaSalle.
Pyo Jun Vin.
Yes, that's right. And he plays Ferdinand and someone else, but I won't give it away now. And, you know, a really wonderful mixture of backgrounds. And what I like about, and what I think is so exciting about, when I first met Kian Lee and Sun Heng, I saw that they were a little bit like me, is that they took from many places. And they were very bravely doing something which nobody else was really doing. And they're now doing it incredibly successfully. I think they probably perform more than any other company in Malaysia. And this is amazing. And then going out. So I wanted to support that, but also grow it in terms of skill, rigor of work. And I think these artists, some of the younger ones, some of the older ones, have great aptitude to great discipline. And, you know, sometimes I get very irritated with people running down Malaysia as a place sometimes because of all kinds of different issues. We've all got problems. Okay, I'm not a, you know, but I think all that's needed is going, no, we're going to do this better. That's all. Just let's get it better. And when I work with young people and I work with older people here, they want to do that. They want to do that, you know, and I think, and I'm very inspired by the artists here in Malaysia, very supportive of them as well. Mm.
Shakespeare is not something that you regularly do. And in many ways, the kinds of works you do are much more contemporary. They engage with current issues. What sort of drew you or brought you into this project?
Well, I think, you know, I'm an old person now. I'm becoming an old person. And actually, I'm very happy to do a ridiculous, stupid comedy. Yeah. And a great fantasy, Tempest is in a way, and then a piece that's very politically close, especially at the moment, which is This Changes Everything, based on Naomi Klein's book about climate change and capitalism. Yeah. Each one has its own quality and requires me. And so I think as I get older, I'm less rigid about what I'll do. I just want to do it well. And I want, most of all, I want to entertain the audience. I want them to go away with joy, but also with, you know, the great tragedies of life in their heart, you know.
How did the collaboration with the KL Shakespeare Players come about?
It started, as it often does, as they came and did my workshops. I was brought here by a wonderful Englishman named Christopher Jacobs, who's, I think, you know, a kind of stalwart of a lot of people's background here in terms of theatre. And I did a workshop and I met them. They did another one and then they kept on bothering me to bother them more, so we did some more. And then we did Romeo and Juliet as an R&D with them. They asked me if I might direct it. I said, I didn't have time. I was very busy. But also, it really isn't the play I'd like to direct, or not Romeo and Juliet. It's actually got a good story. And in a way, it wouldn't give me as much freedom in a way as I like, you know. And then they said, what would you like to do? And I said, well, how about Tempest? It's the first thing came out of my mouth. I'd always, you know, I've seen many productions. I was asked years ago to do a version with Patrick Stewart when he just finished with Star Trek. And I got a call and said, Patrick Stewart would like to see you at the Ivy. So I went along and there was and he was sitting there with a few other notables. And he said, well, David, you know, you've won this award, TMA award for things. So we'd love you to do this Tempest. So we started talking. I said, we're going to use Bhutto dance. He said, I love it. I love it. I'm going to see Bhutto. And then eventually he actually did a production in Shakespeare in the Park in New York, and he got slated, and so he wasn't going to take Shakespeare for a while.
Right, okay.
So I've been close to it a few times, but this is the first time to do it.
And what are some of the specific challenges of doing The Tempest?
I think, again, it's not The Tempest, it's Tempest. The challenge is really, in this case, to, in a very condensed time of an hour and 20 minutes straight through, to get quite a rich and complex story. I feel I teach in nearly 19 countries at the moment around the world, and I think storytelling is becoming a lost art, and it's partly because of all the rubbish films that come out from Hollywood. It's just CGI effects for no reason, you know, and endless cutting. The best stories are actually happening on Netflix often nowadays, and, you know, I think we have to relearn that craft of telling good stories. So I'm very committed to that, and that's probably the most difficult thing, is you've got lots of fantastic characters, great worlds, different styles at times, lots of commedia in terms of crazy latsy going on. I've got some ridiculous music playing sometimes, but it all has to be held together by a plot that gets you from A to Z, and the audience has to understand it.
So that's the thing with The Tempest, isn't it? I mean, you've got these very disparate group of people on an island,
right,
and they're kind of broken up and separated, and each of them almost has their own story.
That's right. Well,
And I'm actually, I know you're not going to give a lot away, but I'm actually very curious about how all of this comes together in, as you said, a 1.5-hour production.
Well, the secret is this, we have a parallel backstory of Prospero happening as a series of flashbacks. And you find out basically how he got to the island and what the relationship with Antonia was, which has nothing to do with really with the one thing I will say, I'll give a little secret here, a little clue without giving it away too much, is his brother is called Antonio Wieland, and he works for the Tyrell Corporation. Now, anybody that knows anything about what I've just said might, I've already dropped it in earlier as well, so you know.
Lots of things to geek out about there, I think.
Yep. I hope there's a lot of geeky people at the front. You know, they'll be on their phones at the same time. This is also built for young people, you know, who have, they often move between film, you know, music and the theatre. I don't want that to, you know, that'll be good.
So I don't want to mention what those refer to.
No, but you know, obviously.
but I'm curious as to, as an audience, what are some of the influences, what are some of the inspirations that we'll recognise?
Oh, gosh. Well, I think, the piece is really a piece of melodrama. Melodrama is a great form. I know it gets a bad press because everybody thinks somehow tasteful theatre is people pretending to be like they are in supermarkets and talking very, you know, these days going a little bumble like that. No, melodrama is basically music with drama. Opera became the very highest form of that. And it's a piece of melodrama. So it's music and sound effect all the way through, a very physical style, and also commedia. At its root, but a modern form of both of these things. So I think you'd see those things, which is what, in fact, influenced Shakespeare. And in fact, some of the biggest productions that were ever done by Shakespeare were melodramas done during the Victorian era by the great actor managers.
How has the show sort of evolved from when it was first conceptualized and now that you're sort of in the thick of the rehearsal process?
Oh, lots and lots. So I said this yesterday. I said to them all, I said, you know, I know you've got a headache ahead of you. We're nearly at the end of Everest and it's getting worse because there's technical things, you know, as it ever is. But I said, look back now and where we started. We started with simply, let's do something that's not The Tempest and let's have a group of people. And I think and we did that in about 4.5 weeks, which is not bad going. I think when you see how far they've gone, they're really a great group. I'm very inspired by them.
In terms of working with a Malaysian crew, this is the first time that you're directing a proper full-length production. Yes, you've toured here before. Yeah. I think you've done some solo shows.
Yes, that's right.
What has that experience been like?
Well, we brought a show here called Gormenghast, which was a big hit here, strangely enough. Saeed Rustam, the composer and sort of musicologist, said it was one of her favourite shows ever. Strangely, you know, but she is a bit of a goth herself, actually. I kind of look at her, I go, she looks like she's a nice Malaysian sort of, but she really should have grown up in Victorian England looking a bit gothic. And so it's so funny, something like Gormenghast, which is so English, and yet people seem to adore it here and still remember it. People come up to me afterwards, and this is like 20 years ago. I did a show a while back. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to swear. It's called Talking Shit. But it was basically, it's a satire because that's all anybody does anymore, sort of talk rubbish, you know. And that was a solo show, quite a physical monologue. And I did solo shows years ago. But I've always found, in a funny sort of way, a great openness here in Malaysia to all sorts of things. And it's partly, I think, because of the different cultures that mix here, that people don't go over the, you know. In fact, in England, I'm often put in a box far more than I am here. You know what I mean? Strange enough, when I'm abroad.
And what box is that?
Well, slightly mavericky, mad, pioneery weirdo who, yes, is very interesting, but please do not mess around with our National Theatre too much. It was very interesting. I had a meeting recently with Rufus Norris, the director of National, and he said, what do you think we should do here? And I said, burn it down.
Oh, dear.
And he said, yes, we thought of that. Maybe that's a possibility. But, you know, it's sort of, you know, there's two sorts of artists, really. I think there's the artists that sit in the middle of the room, and are, you know, they do what they do. And then there are us sort of so-called mavericks, and we sit on the edge and are a bit punky and shout at the middle. But in the end, it doesn't really matter. Artist's job is to provoke. We provoke, evoke, and invoke. That's all we really do. We engage, entertain, and if we're lucky, educate, but not too much. Don't lecture people.
And what has your first experience working with a Malaysian crew been like?
The cast and crew. Great. I mean, you know, great. They like everybody, all people in theatre, they can be a bit lazy sometimes. So your job as a director is to get them to go to places that challenge them. But this group want to be challenged. That's the only difference. When people want to be challenged, then it's not a problem, you know. But we're all, I am as well. You know, I get up at 6 in the morning, I do my yoga, do my swimming. I'd love to lay in, but I don't, you know what I mean?
We all would, I think.
We all would like to. But,
So when we think of this particular production, how does it fit in within sort of the larger body of work that you've been doing?
Well, let me think. This coming up year, I'm doing a show called Mortgage, which is a part of the Divine Comedy, about a stage manager who burns down the last theatre on earth and then rebuilds it out of...
That sounds like the conversation you had.
That's
with...
right. That's right. She rebuilds out the blood, bones and skin of dead of actors she kills. So it's a comedy, you can imagine. Mm-hmm. I'm doing basically a version of Bleak House, a melodrama, which is touring in the UK, and a secret project that is quite a very famous, popular book and film, but I can't talk about yet because we're working on it as a commercial production. And I'll probably get lawyers shouting at me. but I've got more on than I can deal with most of the time. So
is there a sense of, at this point, with all the works that you've done, if someone said, describe to me what a David Glass production is?
Oh, gosh, that's so difficult. I mean, I think it's probably very vivacious, full of, I mean, I talk a lot about the French word élan, mm-hmm. which is lifefulness. Having lifefulness. And you must, the actor, whatever, whether it's Lady Gaga or whether it's Pina Bausch dancer or a Malaysian actress, Nikki, they have to have lifefulness on stage and that pleasure of playing. You know, and also, you know, if you're playing tragedy, you know, when you're King Lear, you're so, the actor is so happy to be so miserable. You must feel that pleasure at the heart of it.
Yeah. You know what I mean? So, why should we come watch this version of The Tempest?
I think you should be surprised, entertained. I think you'll laugh. And I think at the end, you'll have a bloody good cry as well.
Oh, well, thank you very much, David. It was a pleasure having you here.
You're welcome.
I've been speaking to David Glass, who is directing a reimagining of The Tempest at the Kuala Lumpur Performing Arts Centre. The show is on from the 28th to the 31st of March, and tickets priced at RM55 and RM45 for students are available at klpack.org and at the KLPAC box office. If you missed any part of this interview or any previous Front Row segments, you can download the podcasts on our BFM app, on Spotify, and also on our website. You've been listening to Front Row on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.